This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. November is Men's Health Awareness Month, so Talkspace wants guys to know that being prepared for life's biggest challenges and opportunities means prioritizing mental health, too. Talkspace can help you go beyond fine-tuned workouts, supplements, and productivity hacks. Talkspace can help you fine-tune your inner life so you can succeed in being the best version of yourself in any situation. And with Talkspace, you can get therapy from anywhere and on your time. You can even text your therapist between sessions. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace takes most insurance, and most insured members have a $0 copay. Men's Health Awareness Month is the perfect time to reach out to Talkspace. Now, get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com. That's Talkspace.com, promo code SPACE80.
Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Cobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help. You save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.
This is the real Wendy from Peter Pan. Imagine a child, a young girl really, just on the edge of adolescence, simply vanishing from her own nursery and the room locked, bolted from the inside. No forced entry, no footprints outside, nothing. Just this impossible, baffling absence. Now, this isn't some fairy tale we're spinning. This is the true and deeply perplexing case of Wendy Moira Angela Darling. On November 8th, 1899, she disappeared from her family's home in Hampstead, London. The circumstances, well, they still defy every logical explanation we have. It's a mystery, really, that's kind of haunted the annals of the unexplained for, what, over a century now? A chilling historical puzzle just begging for answers. So today, we're going to take a deep dive into the records, the reports, and maybe uncover something far stranger, far more unsettling than any fiction you could possibly devise.
It really is remarkable, isn't it, how quickly a story, almost mythic in how impossible it sounds, can just weave itself right into official records. It blurs the lines, you know, between documented fact and, well, folklore. And the whole idea of real Wendy Darling, it grabs you, definitely. But it also forces us to ask, what does real even mean here, when all our usual ways of understanding things just fail? Are we looking at some kind of historical anomaly, something that just slipped through the cracks of, you know, 19th century science, or maybe a profound misunderstanding of some highly unusual events? Or is it? Is it something else entirely? So we're setting off on a path today where, frankly, our standard explanations are going to be seriously tested. And you listening, you'll be left trying to square the facts with what seems, well, completely impossible.
Okay, so let's pinpoint the start, our journey into this. This inexplicable event begins right there, that crisp autumn morning, November 8th, 1899. The address is 67 Gloucester Road. It's an elegant Victorian house, you know the type, nestled in Hampstead, London. Pretty leafy, respectable area. This was the Darling family home. By all accounts, respectable, well-off family. Their lives were just completely turned upside down by the disappearance of their daughter and the child at the absolute center of this deep mystery, 10-year-old Wendy Moira Angela Darling. Now, the initial discovery that morning, it's laid out pretty starkly in the police reports we've looked at. It sets the stage for everything that follows, and it immediately throws the whole case into the realm of the truly bizarre. Her nursery door. It was found bolted securely from the inside.
Right. And from an investigative perspective, that detail, a door bolted from the inside, it isn't just, like, unusual. It's a massive red flag. Straight away, it raises serious questions about, well, how thorough the initial police investigation really was. Maybe even about their inherent biases back then. You got to remember, 1899. Forensic science was, let's be generous, basic. Very basic. No DNA. Fingerprinting was brand new and kind of unreliable. The whole idea of really meticulous crime scene investigation like we have today, it just didn't exist. Officers, they relied mostly on what they could see and their own sort of ingrained ideas about how criminals behaved. So they see a door locked from the inside, and the immediate thought, probably unchallenged, is, okay, nobody could have gotten out. They weren't necessarily thinking, systematically at least, about every other possibility. You know, were there hidden ways out, a forgotten servant's passage maybe, loose floorboard, anything like that? Could someone have actually been in the room with Wendy, locked up behind them, and then somehow vanished themselves? The sheer physical problem of a sealed room, as described, it often leads investigators, especially back then, to jump to conclusions or just miss crucial details.
And it gets even more intense because it wasn't just the nursery door creating this like impenetrable space. The police reports, and we've really dug into these, they meticulously detail that all the windows in that nursery were locked securely, not just latched, you know? These were probably heavy Victorian windows, solid frames, proper metal catches, built to keep out the cold and, yeah, intruders. And adding to this already baffling scene, there'd been a really heavy frost that night. It coated the ground outside the house in this like perfect undisturbed layer, yet absolutely no footprints. None in that delicate frost. Not a single sign of anyone leaving through a window or even coming up to the house from outside. So this isn't just, you know, a missing kid, not a simple runaway or abduction scenario. This is a child vanishing from a space that seems completely sealed off, an impenetrable room. It's a classic locked room mystery, but real, and it suggests something. Well, something way beyond ordinary crime, something that seems to defy physics, almost.
But that specific point, the no footprints thing, it forces us to ask, right, are we genuinely looking at a perfectly impossible crime scene? Or are we actually dealing with the limits of, you know, 19th century reporting, their investigative tools? Saying no footprints in the frost, it sounds dramatic, sure. But we need to look at that critically. Could the frost have melted? Maybe disturbed naturally by the morning sun? Or even by the police themselves moving around before anyone really looked closely? Were the officers on the scene actually trained to spot tiny details? Or were they maybe just overwhelmed by how strange the whole thing was? So they report a general nothing there instead of a forensically checked absolutely nothing there. Remember, no advanced photography, no specialized gear for preserving scenes back then. So the story, the narrative of an impossible disappearance, it gets a lot of traction when the initial investigation isn't super thorough or when a simple answer just isn't obvious. The human mind, you know, it hates a vacuum. Faced with something like this, it tends to fill the gaps with the extraordinary, sometimes maybe dismissing mundane explanations too quickly.
Okay, but here's where the investigation takes a sharp turn. Away from just puzzling and into something deeply unsettling, something hinting at, well, the fantastical. While the police were doing their meticulous but ultimately useless search of the Darling house, they found something in the attic. And this discovery really shifted the whole feel of the investigation. Across one wall in the attic, you know, a place you'd expect, maybe dusty boxes, old junk, they found these intricate chalk drawings. And apparently these weren't just random scribbles like a kid might normally do. The reports describe them as detailed. Images of ships, like sailing on unseen seas. Star constellations, carefully drawn, and then repeated over and over in what they described as a child's elegant hand, one single haunting word, Neverland. Mm-hmm. This detail, right there in the official police files, it just pushes the whole story into this fantastical space. It makes you wonder, you know, did the ordinary rules of our world even apply to Wendy Darling? Was she trying to tell them something incredibly strange?
But it's definitely worth thinking about the psychological side of those drawings, too. I mean, yes, they sound evocative, fantastical, sure, but kids, they have incredibly vivid imaginations, don't they? They build whole worlds inside their heads. Could Neverland have just been, well, a manifestation of her own rich fantasy life? Maybe an escape, you know, from something troubling her. Even possibly a clue meant to throw people off. Maybe even unintentionally. These drawings could just represent her internal world, like a refuge or a way of projecting her fears, her desires. Not necessarily a literal map to where she went. It's interesting, though, this early report, sounding so fantastical, it kind of foreshadows modern psychological profiling, doesn't it? Looking for symbolic communication at crime scenes. Even if their methods were basic back then, the urge to find meaning in a kid's drawings was clearly there. It suggests they saw a potential link between her inner world and what happened, even if they couldn't quite figure it out.
Yeah, but the whole eerie feeling around 67 Gloucester Road, it didn't just stop with the drawings in the attic. Even after the police finished their initial search, you know, after the house was officially empty and the family presumably weren't staying there, the unsettling reports kept coming. Neighbors, people living right next door to the Darlings, they swore they kept hearing children's voices coming from inside the house, the supposedly silent, empty house. And these weren't just faint whispers you could easily dismiss. They described distinct sounds like laughter and singing. It suggests, well, what? A lingering presence, or maybe just memory playing tricks in the silence after such trauma. This wasn't hard physical evidence, obviously, it's anecdotal testimony, but it's profoundly unsettling stuff, and it definitely fueled all the local rumors and speculation.
And if we broaden out, look at how society reacts. The unreliability of eyewitness accounts, especially when it comes to hearing things during stressful times, that's a really critical factor. The human mind is just incredibly susceptible to suggestion, isn't it? And the power of collective anxiety, especially in a community dealing with a child vanishing like that. grief, fear, that intense need for answers. It can easily make people perceive sights and sounds that aren't actually there. So these reported voices, were they real, external sounds? Or were they more like echoes of the community's fear, their collective longing for Wendy to come back, a desperate search for any explanation projected onto that empty house? It's a common psychological thing, right? People finding meaning in ambiguous sounds or sights, especially when emotions are running high. It can easily get twisted into something supernatural, even if it starts from a very human place. The quiet of an empty house after something dramatic, it can feel deafeningly loud with imagined sounds.
Okay, so the story of Wendy Darling then takes this really dramatic and honestly deeply unsettling turn. We jump forward in time, but it's the first tangible trace of her since she vanished from that locked room, February 14th, 1900, Valentine's Day, ironically, just 3 months after she disappeared from her nursery. 3 months of absolute baffling silence, and then a girl matching Wendy Darling's description is admitted to Westbourne Asylum. Just think about that timeline. A child vanishes without a single clue, then reappears under these very clinical yet totally mystifying circumstances. The entry in the asylum register, it's chillingly vague, almost like the institution itself didn't know how to categorize her. It just says, unknown, patient number 46, female, estimated age 10. But the most immediate and deeply unsettling observation noted by the staff there, the first clue to how strange she was, her condition, growth suspended.
Wow.
That phrase just haunts you, doesn't it? A medical note that seems to fly in the face of nature itself.
We really have to scrutinize that phrase, matching description, though, very carefully. How precise were those kinds of descriptions back in 1900? Especially for a child who, after 3 months missing, might have been changed by whatever she'd been through. Could this easily have been a different child altogether? Maybe someone suffering severe trauma or neglect? Or maybe a similar but completely unrelated medical issue that made her look similar? And the fact that she had no name, that's key. It prevents any immediate, certain identification. It leaves the door wide open for speculation. You know, given the context of Victorian London child poverty, abandonment were tragically common. It's entirely plausible this was just another sad case, a lost or abandoned child brought to the asylum. Not necessarily the miraculous reappearance of the missing Wendy Darling from that impossible room. The leap in assumption, while tempting if you're desperate for answers, needs really careful, critical thought, especially when the claims are this extraordinary.
But the asylum records, even though they start vague, they offer more details. Details that make a connection to Wendy Darling feel, well, almost inescapable. Or at least incredibly compelling. The patient, this girl, explicitly refused her own name. When they asked who she was, she just wouldn't, or maybe couldn't say, like a profound dissociation. And then there was the moment she finally spoke, just once apparently. Mm-hmm. A single haunting sentence uttered when she was really distressed. And it perfectly sums up the eerie nature of her condition, and it echoes those themes, that word Neverland, from the attic wall. She said, apparently in a voice described as small and distant, I'm not allowed to grow up. I mean, that just sends a chill down your spine, doesn't it? A childlike statement that directly contradicts how life works. It just deepens the mystery instead of solving anything.
But it is crucial to consider that I'm not allowed to grow up could be a really powerful psychological manifestation, couldn't it? Rather than a literal biological command, we know extreme trauma, especially in young children, can cause severe psychological effects. Regression, dissociative states, even a complete refusal to engage with a reality that's become unbearable. Kids in distress, they often use metaphors, don't they, to express internal turmoil when they can't say it directly. So this statement, it could easily be a symptom of her mental state, a kind of protective shield against whatever awful reality she might have experienced during those 3 missing months. Not necessarily some supernatural decree affecting our body. The mind has incredible ways of protecting itself, right? That might effectively suspend itself in childhood as a coping mechanism, even if the body technically continues. The challenge for the asylum staff back then, of course, would be telling the difference between the psychological and the physiological. And Victorian psychiatry just wasn't equipped for that kind of nuance.
What makes the case for a literal physiological thing seem stronger, though, is the progression. Or rather, the complete lack of progression of her condition. It was meticulously documented inside Westbourne Asylum. The nurses, later the doctors, they watched her with just, you can imagine, increasing bewilderment. By 1905, that's a full 5 years after she was admitted, this girl hadn't aged a single day. Not visibly, anyway. She would have been 16 years old biologically, assuming the initial age estimate was right. But she still physically looked 10. Every measurable thing, her height didn't change, her weight stayed exactly the same as on day one. Even tiny details like her handwriting, her teeth based on dental records, the texture of her skin, all identical to when she first arrived. This wasn't just, you know, slow growth or delayed development, that term they sometimes use for kids maturing slower. This was absolute irrefutable stasis, a complete and total stop in the biological aging process. The asylum records state they'd never seen anything like it, ever.
Yeah, that extreme presentation, it really forces you to ask, well, what else could cause such a dramatic, absolute stop to growth and aging, even if it's incredibly rare? While the level described sounds unique, arrested development was a medical term they used back then. It covered various things causing stunted growth or delayed maturity, often linked to, say, severe malnutrition or chronic illness. Could this possibly have been an extreme, maybe completely off-the-charts case of malnutrition that messed up her endocrine system? Or maybe a specific hormonal disorder that was just totally unknown at the time? Or perhaps an incredibly rare genetic anomaly that early 20th century medicine simply couldn't understand or identify? They didn't have modern endocrinology, genetic testing, sophisticated imaging, none of that. So a diagnosis of arrested development might have just been a catch-all for anything weird. But the specific details here, the total stasis, that suggests something much more profound than typical arrested development. We have to consider all possible biological explanations, however unlikely they seem in that historical context, before we jump straight to the truly extraordinary or inexplicable.
And then there's one of the most, frankly, heart-wrenching details in those asylum records, also deeply revealing. Eventually, Wendy Darling's parents, they just stop visiting her. Can you imagine the profound despair, the agonizing confusion they must have felt, the sheer hopelessness to see your own daughter just locked in this timeless state, unchanging, unmoving beyond basic functions? It must have been an unbearable thing to witness. This stopping of contact, it speaks volumes about just how strange her condition was. Maybe it was simply an inability to cope with a child who would never grow up. Maybe a kind of psychological detachment set in, where they started to feel she wasn't really their child anymore, like a changeling or a ghost. Or maybe, maybe it was just a terrible unspoken acceptance that this was an irreversible reality they just couldn't understand, leaving them no choice but to withdraw into their own grief and confusion.
It's definitely worth remembering the immense psychological burden something like this would place on parents, especially in an era with basically zero mental health support for such unique, bizarre situations. Is them stopping visits? Yeah, it could absolutely be a sign of their complete inability to cope, a profound kind of psychological defense mechanism against a reality that was just too painful, too incomprehensible to face day after day. And don't forget the social stigma around asylums and mental illness back then. That would only have made their suffering worse, incredibly isolating. It's a deeply human part of the story that often gets overlooked in these strange accounts, isn't it? The silent suffering of the family left behind, grappling with this incomprehensible loss, not of life exactly, but of a future, of growth, of just the natural way parenthood is supposed to unfold. Withdrawing, while it seems cold on the surface, might have been their only way to psychologically survive something so profoundly unnatural.
Okay, so we've traced this path from an impossible vanishing act, a locked room mystery, to a child seemingly frozen solid in time within the, you know, sterile but baffling walls of a Victorian asylum. But the story doesn't just end there with historical observation. Much later, scholars started reviewing these deeply unsettling records, but they had the advantage, right? A century of medical progress, different perspectives. And they began to suspect something much more specific than that vague old diagnosis of arrested development. They connect Wendy's case to a condition that, using modern medical language, is now sometimes called Syndrome X. Now, this reframing, it gives it a potential medical label, a name for something that seemed unnameable, but it still leaves the core mystery completely untouched. It gives us a classification, maybe, but definitely not a solution. It just underlines how little we still really understand about cases like this.
Yeah. And it's important to contextualize that term, Syndrome X. In medicine, it often kind of acts as a placeholder, doesn't it? It's the label we stick on things that are currently just beyond our full scientific grasp. It's often a diagnosis of exclusion, meaning you rule out everything known. And if you're still left with a consistent set of weird symptoms or a unique outcome, you might call it Syndrome X. But is it a formally recognized diagnosis? Does it have clear, identifiable biological markers you can test for? Or is it more just a descriptive term for these extreme, unexplained cases of growth stopping where no other known cause fits? That distinction really matters. It could just be describing the outcome growth stops without actually explaining why or how it happens biologically. It's like trying to bridge the gap between the totally unexplained and something medically recognized, but the bridge itself might be pretty shaky. That highlights the frontiers of what we know.
Well, based on the sources we've looked into, Syndrome X is defined a bit more precisely than just a vague placeholder, at least in this context. It's described as a rare, profound disorder where biological age halts completely, leaving the body permanently frozen in childhood. So this isn't just growth slowing down. It's not delayed development where, you know, the child eventually catches up. It's described as a complete and absolute cessation of the aging process self. Think about all the complex cellular stuff that governs growth and aging hormones, genetics, everything working together. Syndrome X, as these modern scholars looking at these old cases see it, suggests a total interruption of that whole biological symphony. Not a slowdown, an outright stop. And that's what makes Wendy's case feel so unique and deeply disturbing. It's a medical anomaly that just defies our basic understanding of biology. Can you imagine living in a world where your body just stops moving forward through time while everyone else keeps aging, changing, eventually passing away? It's a terrifying idea, a kind of living limbo.
And it's definitely worth noting that claim only a handful of cases have ever been documented, like ever, for anything like this. Which raises an important question, doesn't it, about why it's so extremely rare. Does its rarity make it inherently more mysterious? Or does it just mean it's incredibly hard to study, hard to categorize, hard to even identify accurately without looking back retrospectively like this? Are these few documented cases truly identical in how they work biologically? Or are they just grouped together because they look similar? This weird arrested development that baffles doctors. The rarer something is, the harder it is to find a pattern, right? Harder to do targeted research, harder to get beyond just labeling it towards understanding what actually causes it. It also makes you wonder if maybe similar cases were just missed entirely in the past, misdiagnosed, ignored, or simply never recorded because they didn't have the tools or concepts we have now. So this challenge in studying something so rare, it kind of perpetuates the mystery, even while we try to slap a name like Syndrome X on it.
So even with this modern label, Syndrome X, even looking back with all our advanced medical knowledge, the basic questions about Wendy Darling just remain stubbornly unanswered. What exactly triggered this in her? Was it something external, something that happened during those 3 missing months? Some strange encounter, maybe traumatic, that flipped a biological switch? Or was it something internal, a deep-seated genetic predisposition, maybe dormant, that just suddenly kicked in for no apparent reason? Mm-hmm. Or was it something else entirely, something still completely outside our understanding, a combination of factors we can't even guess at? The classification, Syndrome X, it gives us a name, a box to put it in with other rare anomalies, but it offers zero real answers to the fundamental why. If anything, it just amplifies the whole eerie historical mystery, makes it feel even more profound, more unsettling.
And when the facts themselves really do become stranger than fiction, when documented reality just refuses to fit into our neat, rational boxes, the human mind, well, it struggles immensely. Faced with something like Wendy's case, we instinctively try to categorize it, don't we? We either try to explain it medically, even if the explanation is vague, like Syndrome X, or we assign it to the realm of myth, folklore, the supernatural. We turn it into a modern legend. Syndrome X, even in its definition, a disorder where biological age just halts, it kind of tries to bridge that gap, right? Tries to pull the inexplicable into the medical world. But in doing that, it paradoxically just highlights how much we don't know, how vast the unexplored territories still are in human biology and maybe the universe itself. It really forces us to confront the limits of our scientific understanding and the enduring power of a genuine mystery. #outro.
And so, the narrative of Wendy Darling, a story that started with an impossible vanishing, continued with a life apparently frozen in time, it brings us to its official yet profoundly unsatisfying close, yeah. Right there in the bureaucratic records of the asylum. In 1912, the hospital authorities, maybe just completely stumped by what to do with a patient who simply wouldn't age, wouldn't change, they sealed her file, the final entry. It offers no death date, no information about release, no definitive diagnosis even then, just a final chilling note about her ongoing stay. It's almost as if her existence just ceased. Within those pages, a record of a life suspended, a person frozen, officially noted, and then just tucked away into the administrative void. Too baffling to understand, too unique to categorize properly, and you, the listener, you're left with that. The stark, bureaucratic end, a chilling full stop to a story that feels utterly impossible.
It's fascinating, though, isn't it? That bureaucratic impulse, trying to contain something that's fundamentally uncontainable, trying to formally close a file on something that defies any normal kind of closure, the act of just sealing the file. With no resolution, no death date, no release, it speaks volumes, really. It's like an administrative surrender to the inexplicable. It's a formal acknowledgement, almost, that this case just breaks all the standard procedures, breaks understanding, it leaves this gaping void where answers and closure should be. Bureaucracy loves to categorize, control, impose order, right? But here, all it could do was formally acknowledge its own incomprehension. It just emphasizes the profound mystery it couldn't solve or even properly contain. It's like an administrative tombstone for a life that refused to end in any way they could recognize.
So what does this all mean for you? Hearing this story, this deeply unsettling account of a child who just stopped. Wendy Darling's documented experience, sitting there in official records, it exists in this strange kind of limbo. It's a real-life echo, isn't it? Of all those stories we tell, the myths we create about children who never grow up, who stay forever untouched by time, eternally young, forever lost to the world that just keeps moving on without them.
It really does beg the question, doesn't it? When facts themselves become stranger than any fiction we could invent, when documented reality defies our most basic rational frameworks, how do we, as people, square that? How do we reconcile our deep-seated need for logical explanations with the profound mysteries that history sometimes just throws at us, especially when those mysteries touch the very core of what it means to live, to grow, to experience the passage of time?
Her file closes with two words, child suspended.
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.